This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Dead Before Dark by Wendy Corsi Staub. This book is read by Emily Sutton Smith. This book is dedicated to my dear friends, Chris and Anita, Lucas and Gabriella, and to Mark, Morgan, and Brody, with love. With gratitude to William Rasmussen for his endless patience with my endless queries about FBI procedure. Any errors in that regard are my own, and Bill gets the credit for all that rings true. Bill, I couldn't have done it without you. Prologue. Attica, New York, June. They called him the Night Watchman. Back in the late 60s, he stole into women's homes after dark on nights when the moon was full and they were alone. He slaughtered them, and always left an eerie calling card at the crime scene. The authorities never publicly revealed what it was. For over a year, the killer engaged in a deadly game of cat and mouse with the local police and FBI, the press, and the jittery populations of cities he so sporadically struck beneath a full moon, claiming seemingly random female victims. No one ever did manage to figure out how or why he chose the women he killed. The only certainty was that he watched them closely in the days or weeks leading up to their deaths, learned their routines, knew precisely where and when to catch them alone at night, off guard and vulnerable. Out of the blue, the killing stopped. Months went by without a telltale murder, then years. The Night Watchman murders joined a long list of legendary unsolved American crimes, perhaps the most notorious since the Borden Axe murders almost a century before. Unsolved? Of course, Lizzie was guilty as hell. She was acquitted based only on the Victorian presumption that a homicidal monster couldn't possibly dwell within a genteel lady. Back then, few suspected that pure evil was quite capable of lurking behind the most benign of facades. 100 years later, as the Night Watchman went about his gruesome business undetected, even those who knew him best had yet to catch on. He, like others who would come after him, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, was a monster masquerading as a gentleman. Unlike the others, though, he was never apprehended. Not for the Night Watchman murders, anyway. A theory came to light, when the bloodbath was so suddenly curtailed, that the killer had either died himself or been jailed for another crime. As the decade drew to a close, the lingering public fascination with the Night Watchman faded and was finally eclipsed by interest in the elusive Zodiac killer. Years went by. Decades dawned and waned. The 1900s gave way to a shiny new millennium. Once in a while, some unsolved crimes buff would turn the media spotlight on the Night Watchman. For the most part, though, he remained shrouded in shadow, and has to this day. Ah, well, the darkest night always gives way to dawn. He emerges into the hot glare of summer sunlight on what happens to be the longest day of the year. Fitting, isn't it? He smiles at the final uniformed guard standing sentry over his path to freedom. The guard doesn't smile back. They never have. They simply keep a joyless, steady vigil, scrutinizing the most mundane human activities, day in and day out, night in and night out. Night in and night out. Ha! No joy in it for prison guards, anyway. Street clothes are on his back for the first time in 3.5 decades. Bus fare home is stashed in his pocket, if he had a home to go to. 35 years is a long time. But finding a place to live is the last thing on his mind as he walks toward the bus stop, free at last, with the nightfall hours away. New York City, August. 5 minutes, acute 20-something production assistant announces, sticking her short, chic haircut into the green room. Lucinda Sloane promptly pulls out a compact, snaps it open, and finds a stranger looking back at her. Oh, for the love of... The reflection shakes its head. Thanks to the morning show's makeup artist, she's wearing more makeup than usual. A lot more makeup. More makeup, quite possibly, than she's ever worn in her life. Or at least since her sixth-grade co-ed dance at the Millwood Academy, a milestone occasion for which she also stuffed her bra with toilet paper. 20 years later, that's hardly necessary. But if it were, she wouldn't bother. These days, she's strictly a lip gloss and blue jeans kind of girl. But if Lucinda Sloane has learned anything at all in this 48-hour media feeding frenzy, it's that pre-camera primping is de rigueur here in the big leagues. All national television news show guests are plopped into the hair and makeup chair, regardless of whether they're a movie star or a run-of-the-mill psychic who just helped snag a notorious Jersey Shore serial killer. Though she belongs in the latter category, Lucinda looks, at the moment, like the former. It's the lipstick. Definitely. Her mouth is slicked red, the very shade of fresh blood. Maybe that was the intent, given the macabre topic of her impending segment. Blood. Lucinda suppresses a shudder, remembering the gore she encountered at a secluded Monmouth County farmhouse just a few days ago. Thank God the only blood shed at the final crime scene belonged to the killer, slain by the cops to save the would-be victim's life. 14-year-old Tess Hastings is now laid up with a broken leg at home in Montclair. Her parents, Camden and Mike, have protected her from the press so far, but they're here in the green room themselves. Mike, handsome in a suit, sits with a protective arm around his pregnant wife, as though someone is going to snatch her away. And no wonder, after their ordeal. Your family is safe now. The lunatic can't hurt you, or anyone else, ever again, Lucinda wants to tell him. Trouble is, that wouldn't help. Once you've encountered violent evil, you never feel safe in this world again. Who knows that better than Lucinda? Her life's work has taken her to the darkest places imaginable, has shown her that human beings are capable of inflicting unspeakable cruelty. She learned long ago not to let any of it get to her, at least not on the outside. She's not about to spend her life looking over her shoulder. She's a Sloane, after all. Generations before her have traditionally valued a stiff upper lip almost as much as they have their material possessions. Lucinda might have eschewed the trappings of wealth in her adult life, but when high pressure hits, her own facade is stolid as the stone mansion where she grew up. She sighs and snaps the compact closed. Don't worry. You look great. The compliment, courtesy of Detective Randall Barricat, inspires an unwanted spark of satisfaction. Thanks. Feeling his eyes on her, not about to return the gaze, she busies herself wiping imaginary lipstick off her teeth. An imminent live on-air interview is nerve-wracking enough. Sitting so close to Randy that she can smell his tic-tac breath takes that stress to a whole new level. The Hastings case brought them together again after 3 years, but only professionally. Randy's married now, living 70 miles away from Philly on Long Beach Island, and Lucinda's long over him. Not. But hey, she's one hell of an actress. Randy, on the other hand, wouldn't win any Oscars for his performance since their paths crossed again last month. Lucinda doesn't have to be psychic to know that he, too, has unresolved feelings. But she wouldn't tap that vein if it were made of gold. Hey, what about me? His voice conveniently barges into her thoughts. Huh? What about me? Randy repeats. Do I look okay? Reluctantly, she glances up at him. Black hair, blue eyes, dimples, bronzed skin. Yeah, he looks okay. And then some. Lucinda, can I borrow your mirror for a second? Camden Hastings asks, and Lucinda hands it over. Cam, an attractive olive-skinned brunette, has also been glammed up for the cameras. Her lipstick, though, is a subtle pearly pink. Lucinda should be wearing pink lipstick, too, or a nice summer peach shade, or, hey, here's a thought, how about no lipstick at all? Wistful, Lucinda figures that right about now, on an ordinary Monday morning, she'd be home wearing an old t-shirt, dishing up her usual breakfast, Cap'n Crunch or Frosted Flakes, coffee, and a can of Pepsi. Then again, the green room spread isn't too shabby. She was able to snag 2 glazed donuts and a Pepsi before heading into the makeup chair for the works, from foundation to curled eyelashes. Next, she visited the hairstylist, who chattily tamed her auburn waves. Lucinda typically lets her hair hang down her back unfettered. It now nests sedately in a jeweled barrette at the nape of her neck. Her hair is behaving itself, and the lipstick hasn't yet made its way onto her teeth, so she's good to go. Not bad for a lip gloss and blue jeans kind of girl. Yeah, and she can't wait to ditch the barrette, scrub her face, and stick this little black Chanel dress back in her spare closet. Way, way back, where it belongs, hanging beside the other relics of her society girl past. She's kept only a few designer items. They come in handy for occasions like weddings, charity functions, funerals, lunch with her mother, only slightly more appealing than funerals, and national television appearances. This happens to be her 5th national television appearance in the last 48 hours, and in her entire life. She's starting to get the hang of it, though. Her family isn't. In Bitsy and Rudolph Sloan's world, a woman's only proper place in the newspapers is on the society pages, or the obituaries. Her parents were horrified to see their only child splashed all over the news. They've left several messages to let her know. Do you ever pick up the phone for them? Cam asked when her mother's number popped up on her cell earlier. Pretty much never. That's so sad. Cam's reaction caught Lucinda off guard. It's been years since she questioned her relationship, or lack thereof, with her parents. Years since she went from being a poor little love-deprived rich girl to a self-sufficient woman whose life is enriched by friends and work, a vacation that, ironically, led to the communication breakdown with her parents in the first place. Tic-tac. Randy again. He produces a plastic box, gives it a little shake. No thanks, Lucinda can't resist adding, as he pops yet another green pellet into his mouth. I don't want to go on TV with a green tongue.
I have a green tongue?
I've seen worse. But hey, your breath is minty fresh. Cam returns the compact and checks her watch.
Hasn't it been more than 5 minutes?
Not even 2. Mike rubs circles in the small of her back. Take a deep breath and relax.
You make it sound so easy.
Cam has been looking at her watch repeatedly for the last 20 minutes, anxious, Lucinda knows, not to get the latest interview underway, but to get it over with. With their daughter safe and sound, their recently troubled marriage back on track, and another baby on the way, the Hastings have no interest in being on TV. They wouldn't be here at all if it weren't for Ava Neary. It was Lucinda who alerted Cam that her older sister's long-ago death might not have been a suicide after all. Maybe I shouldn't have told her, or at least not so soon after what happened to Tess. But Cam needed to know, after all these years of trying to reconcile her own turbulent past, that 19-year-old Ava didn't jump from the top floor of a Manhattan building that long-ago day. She was pushed to her death. Lucinda expected Cam to dispute, or at least question, that claim, based as it is on nothing more than a psychic vision of Ava struggling with a hooded figure before the fall. But Cam didn't dispute it. Maybe deep down, she already suspected the truth. All this media attention over the serial killer is a golden opportunity to shed light on Ava's case.
Whoever took her life might still be out there. Someone, somewhere, might know something.
The Hastings agreed to all these interviews with the stipulation that Ava would be prominently featured, and that Tess would not. The press would have a field day if they knew that the rescued girl's mother, like Lucinda, is a clairvoyant.
But Cam's abilities are under wraps, and it was officially Lucinda's ESP that led the police to the killer.
Only Lucinda, Mike, and Randy are aware that Cam was having visions of her daughter's abduction long before it became a frightening reality. Lucinda returns the compact to her bag, a vintage Hermes Kelly, named after the late Princess of Monaco, who, like Lucinda herself, was a product of Philadelphia's main line. First Hollywood, then a real-life Prince Charming, whisked Grace Kelly away from all that. Granted, her fairy tale ending had a fatal postscript, but at least the dashing Rainier claimed her as his royal bride. Not so for Lucinda Sloane. Her would-be prince married Carla Carnecki, the proverbial truck-stop waitress with a heart of gold. She was already Randy's live-in fiancée back when Lucinda met him. Yet Lucinda felt an instant tug of attraction the moment they met and sensed that it was mutual, despite his being engaged. Of course she fought it. So did he. But working together day after day, night after night, under the most exhausting, heart-wrenching of circumstances, their emotions on edge, maybe it was inevitable that Lucinda and Randy would wind up in each other's arms sooner or later. It only happened a few times, and they both hated themselves for it. Meanwhile, an oblivious Carla was blissfully planning the wedding, dutifully saving her tips for her dream house, and caring for her dying mother, Zelda. Randy wanted to break the engagement. Lucinda told him not to do it, not for her sake. She never really understood why she reacted that way, and she later regretted it, thinking of what might have been. But at the time, it was a gut reaction, and she always trusted her instincts. Maybe she was so drawn to Randy because he was unavailable. Maybe she was too independent back then, freshly sprung from her gilded cage, not ready for all that their relationship would entail if he were free. Maybe she just couldn't handle what his leaving Carla would do to her conscience. Maybe she was afraid of needing him, needing anyone. Maybe, maybe, maybe. So much uncertainty. She loathes uncertainty, and it dogged every move she made with Randy, even after it was over. Did she expect Randy to tell her she was wrong about them? Did she want him to fight for her, make her change her mind? As if anyone ever could. But if anyone could, it was him. Didn't he know that? No, he didn't know. Anyway, girls like Carla deserve a fairy tale ending, right? Randy transferred to an out-of-state job on the Jersey Shore, married Carla. Lucinda built a nice little life for herself and put the past behind her. Now that not Prince Charming is back on the scene, though, she's got her work cut out for her. With three more joint press interviews scheduled in the next 2 days, Lucinda can't escape Randy just yet. Okay, let's go. Cell phones off, everyone. You're on right after the author interview. The production assistant is back to herd Lucinda, Randy, and the Hastingses down the hall toward the studio. People stride importantly past them in both directions, clipboards and props in hand. The scene is becoming familiar. Lucinda knows what to expect beyond that soundproof door. On-air talent who are household names, authoritative producers, bustling stagehands, jeans-clad cameramen, bright lights, a clip-on mic, Arctic air conditioning. The door opens, and in they go. Yep, right again. Lucinda is getting to be an old hand at this TV stuff. Nervous? Randy whispers as they're led to the interview chairs. Nah, are you? Uh-uh. Liar. He shrugs, grins. We can't all be as cool and composed as the comely clairvoyant. She rolls her eyes. He's quoting yesterday's New York Post, which Lucinda's friend Bradley Carmichael, who lives in Manhattan, called and woke her to tell her about at 5:30 a.m. when it was hot off the press. "Your tabloid star, darling." Bradley, on his way to the gym, has always been oblivious to the fact that some people aren't up at dawn to work out.
"Just like Paris and Brittany."
Not quite. But the press has been all over this story, particularly her role in it. She's pretty much been portrayed as a sexy soothsayer superhero, that being this morning's Daily News tagline beneath a particularly flattering photo of her. The Daily News says you have a smokin' hot Jennifer Aniston bod and a Demi Moore bedroom voice.
Bedroom voice? She laughed at that.
If I'd been in a bedroom lately, I wouldn't have this voice.
Meaning?
Meaning I always get hoarse when I'm overtired, she informed Bradley.
Well, the world doesn't know that. The world thinks you're a smoldering femme fatale.
Forget the world. Lucinda can't help but wonder what Randy's wife thinks of all this. Is Carla at home watching right now? If so, will she suspect that her husband and the comely clairvoyant / sexy soothsayer superhero were once a hot item? Probably not. Anyway, what does it matter? Once is the key word. Once upon a time. Yeah. Unlike Princess Grace and Carla Carnecki Barakat, Lucinda Sloane only got the fairy tale beginning. Middlebury, Vermont.
Never, ever, ever turn on the television in the daytime. You do, and it's all over.
That was the advice Vic Shattuck's former colleague David Goodlow gave him upon his mandatory retirement from the Bureau's Behavioral Studies Unit last summer. Dave had already been retired for a good decade by then and was full of other nuggets of advice, which didn't, thank God, include buying an RV. Vic's had his fill of travel over a 25-year career with the FBI. Not so with Dave, who's on yet another cruise with his wife this month, somewhere in the Mediterranean. Vic found that out from Dave's son, who answered the phone when Vic called this morning to ask, with regard to turning on the television in the daytime, "What's all over? The day? Life as I knew it? What? Is it really so bad?" Vic's wife Kitty had left for work a little while ago as he settled into his chair in front of the TV.
"What are you going to do today?" she asked.
"Same as I do every day. A whole lot of nothing."
He saw the look in her eyes.
Kitty can say less with silence than most women can say with a week's worth of words.
Vic has never been big on television, daytime or otherwise. He managed to follow Dave's advice at first, resettled with Kitty to their native New England after years living near Quantico. He golfed every day the weather would allow. Kitty, who doesn't golf, went stir-crazy after a few idle weeks and found an accounting job at the university. On rainy days, he kept busy with Kitty's lengthy honey-do list around their new, albeit centuries-old, saltbox home, mostly landscaping. But then winter settled over the mountains of New England, and there wasn't much to do, around the house or otherwise. One morning, Vic turned on the television to see if it was going to snow. It was, big surprise, and wound up watching the entire morning newscast waiting for weather updates. The storm held off till the next day, so he tuned in again to check the local closings and cancellations list. Not that he had anywhere to be, and not that a winter storm in the mountains of Vermont was out of the ordinary in the least. But it was good, sitting there in front of the wood-burning stove with a cup of coffee, catching up on what's been going on in the world. Not as fulfilling as working, of course, but he didn't have a choice about that. You reach 57, and ready or not, there you go. You miss your job and the people. You try to stay busy. You think about the things you did right and the things you'd do differently, and always about the one that got away. When spring came, he started golfing again, until he threw out his back. 2 specialists and 1 surgery later, he's been ordered to stay away from the golf course until it's fully healed. So here he is,
on a beautiful summer morning, watching the morning news as has become his daily habit. He'll follow it up with a couple of lame talk shows targeted toward women and channel surf after lunch, avoiding the shopping networks. The way he sees it, as long as he stays away from home shopping, he's not pathetic. And as long as he remembers to keep dirty dishes out of the sink and fold the laundry, Kitty doesn't seem to think he's pathetic either. At least she doesn't say it. Maybe it was better when he was pleasantly oblivious to the news, though. Between the political coverage out of Washington, a passenger airliner crash in South America, and another hurricane bearing down on the Gulf Coast, things are looking pretty grim. Vic looks around for the remote to turn the channel. "This morning," the beautiful anchorwoman says, "we're going to talk with a New Jersey woman who, as a child, overcame the tragic suicide of her older sister, only to have her young daughter abducted by a serial killer just days ago. Meet the police detective and beautiful psychic who teamed up to rescue the teen and apprehend the killer, and learn why they are seeking new information on the decades-old so-called suicide." So-called suicide. In other words, they're looking into the possibility that it might have been a homicide. Interesting. Vic stops looking for the remote. "But first," the anchor continues, "we have the author of a new book on the disappearance of aviator Amelia Earhart, and he claims to have solved the mystery at last." Ah, Amelia Earhart, one of the great unsolved mysteries of all time. Solved? Vic watches the segment with interest. The author is a journalist who has spent the past 2 years with a team of scientists digging up convincing forensic evidence on an island in the South Pacific. "What made you decide to write this book?" the author is asked as the interview winds to a close. The journalist shrugs. "I've just always been obsessed with what happened to her." "I know the feeling, buddy," Vic mutters. It was an obsession with an unsolved case that led him to FBI work in the first place. He'd gotten interested in crime back when he was a psych major and a notorious murderer was terrorizing the Northeast, the one the press called the Night Watchman. He became so fascinated by newspaper accounts of the murders that Kitty, who was just his girlfriend at the time, had a suggestion for him. "Why don't you solve the case?" "Because I'm not a detective." Kitty just looked at him. The next thing he knew, he'd changed his mind about becoming a shrink. With Kitty's support, he filled out applications, endured tough interviews, passed incredibly difficult tests. Eventually, he found himself in a 4-month FBI training program in Quantico. As an agent in the 70s, when a rash of what his future mentor Robert K. Ressler coined serial killing took hold across the country, Vic grew even more fascinated by the criminal mind. Curious about what made human monsters tick, he found that his earlier interest in psychology came in handy on the job. For 4 years, he took college courses in deviant psychology by night, hunted down the bad guys by day. It might not have been the dream situation for a happily married father of 4 kids, the youngest being twins, but he and Kitty made it work. It all came together when he earned his master's and was assigned to the FBI's BSU as a criminal profiler. There he studied the complex cases of known killers, including the most notorious of all time, Charles Manson, and applied what he learned to active, unsolved cases, and to inactive cases. Revisiting the long-exhausted evidence on the Night Watchman murders, he pored over every detail and conjured a profile of the perpetrator. He anticipated what the unknown subject's next moves were likely to have been, and came up with a proactive plan to lay a trap for him. All the while, he imagined the satisfaction he would find in solving one of the most notorious cold cases in Bureau history. It didn't happen. He profiled the killer as an organized, highly intelligent white male. He was young, probably in his early 20s at the most when the crimes occurred. His relationships with women were unfulfilling.
He felt no remorse after killing and was in no hurry to get away. On the contrary, he meticulously staged the victims and left a distinct calling card at the scene. Yes, Vic knew who they were looking for. He just didn't know when or where or whether the unsub would strike again. He didn't. Still, not a day goes by, even after almost 40 years, that Vic Shattuck doesn't wonder what happened to the night watchman. All those brutal killings, and then nothing. Vic has a theory, of course, just like everyone else who ever had anything to do with the case. The killer either died or went to prison for some unrelated crime. For years after the murders had ended, the evidence boxed away, pending inactive, Vic held his breath. He waited for him to reemerge, waited for another woman to turn up dead at the hands of the night watchman. There were a number of crimes with a similar M.O. Woman who lives alone is killed by an intruder in the night. One, years after the last known night watchman murder, was even an obvious and flimsy copycat crime. It was a domestic abuse case that ended in murder, and the husband tried to make it look otherwise. No one bought it for a minute, not even the press. The moon wasn't even full that night. But for the investigators, the dead giveaway, as it were, was that the night watchman's calling card, the one that had never been revealed to the public, was conspicuously absent at the scene. The victim's lips hadn't been smeared with red lipstick. It's the red lipstick that gets him. It always has been. She's a beautiful woman, yeah. Great body, skinny with big boobs, just the way he likes them. Who doesn't? But that luscious red mouth has him mesmerized, even before he actually hears the words spilling from it in a hauntingly throaty voice, or reads the caption superimposed over her image. Lucinda Sloan, psychic detective. Fascinating. Utterly fascinating. Yes, I've been involved in missing persons work for years now, she informs the handsome interviewer in a throaty voice. But they don't always turn out this way. In other words, the interviewer says, you don't always catch the bad guy or woman, as the case may be. This was just a lucky break. She appears to weigh her response carefully before acknowledging. It was absolutely a lucky break in the sense that Tess Hastings' life was saved, but two other girls lost theirs to a ruthless serial killer. I understand you were working with the police to find those missing kids and had had visions of their deaths before Tess Hastings was kidnapped?
Yes.
And you tend to use a process called psychometry, is that right? You make physical contact with something that belonged to the person you're trying to find, say a piece of jewelry or clothing, and you are then able to glean information about the person?
That's right. Psychometry.
He finds a scrap of paper and a pen, writes the word down along with Lucinda Sloan, psychic detective. And that's what you did in the case of those two missing girls?
Yes.
Did you ever think there was hope of finding them, Miss Sloan?
For a moment, she bites her luscious lower lip. Then, shaking her head, she says, I didn't know. It's not an exact science, but in my line of work, I'm brought in after the fact. So with my visions, I tend to see things after they happen.
In other words, when it's too late.
She nods.
Do you ever get immune to dealing with human anguish on a daily basis?
Not immune. I guess accustomed is a better word.
How do you cope?
It's never easy. You have to be able to compartmentalize your life. You know, remove yourself from it.
Remove yourself, the reporter nods. I understand that you were supposed to be on an Alaskan cruise vacation right about now, but you missed the boat, so to speak, in order to help find Tess Hastings.
That's right, she shrugs. It's not a big deal.
Detective Barakat,
Hindsight is 20/20, but I'm sure there are some on your force who might have criticized you at the time for putting any stock into a psychic's visions.
Regrettably, the camera shifts to a man whose caption reads, Detective Randall Barricat, Long Beach Township.
Well, it's not like I went around broadcasting it. How did her involvement come about? Was it official or unofficial?
Unofficial. I mean, I've known Lucinda for years. We used to work together on missing persons cases when I was back in Philly. I've seen her do some amazing things.
Oh, you have you?
The detective's gold wedding band is clearly visible as he fidgets with his lapel. The guy is married. Not to the amazing Lucinda with the luscious red lips, or the caption would undoubtedly say so. But something in the man's blue eyes, a flicker of admiration, a flash of regret, a glimmer of lust, perhaps, conveys that Detective Randall Barricat has more than casual interest in Lucinda Sloan, psychic detective.
Interesting.
They're calling Lucinda a superhero these days, Detective Barricat. Do you agree?
Sure. You know, danger goes with the territory when you're a cop. But Lucinda? She's fearless. Nothing ever fazes her.
The camera darts back to her as the interviewer asks,
What do you say to that, Lucinda? Is there anything at all you're afraid of?
The dark, she says promptly, almost glibly, with a jittery little laugh and a sidewise glance at the detective.
Again, interesting. You're afraid of the dark?
The interviewer looks amused.
But she's not kidding. She means it.
I can tell.
Ever since I was a little girl. I guess I always figured bad things couldn't happen in broad daylight, you know? When the sun goes down, the boogeyman comes out.
His gaze narrows. He stares thoughtfully at her until the camera cuts away again to a man and woman identified as Camden and Michael Hastings, parents of kidnapped girl. The interviewer drones on, questioning them about their ordeal. His mind drifts until the screen shifts again. In sheer disbelief, he finds himself looking at a vintage photo captioned Ava Neary, supposed 1970 NYU suicide, sister of Camden Hastings. Now that Mr. and Mrs. Hastings's daughter has been found, they, with the assistance of Lucinda Sloan, are looking into the death of Mrs. Hastings's sister, who supposedly jumped to her death from a building at New York University over 35 years ago.
Well, well, well. What a small world.
Lucinda Sloan's red mouth announces, We're asking anyone who knew Ava Neary at NYU and might have any information on the period leading up to her death to please come forward.
A small world indeed, he thinks, as an idea ignites in the mind once deemed, by a court-ordered psychiatric evaluation, competent to stand trial for matricide. Tried, convicted, sentenced, rehabilitated. Time served. Case closed. No longer a threat to society. Or so it was assumed last June, when the night watchman was unwittingly released after serving 35 years in prison.
Part 1, 540. Chapter 1.
When it's over, he stands back to survey his handiwork. Almost. He reaches out with a gloved hand to adjust the sleeve of her pajama top, pulling it lower on her wrist. Better. He pushes back a few strands of her hair, the better to assess the frozen grimace on her mouth.
Ah, very nice indeed.
He pries open the corpse's clenched right fingers. First, he slides the silver signet ring from the pinky and puts it aside. Then he unzips the pocket of his down jacket and pulls out a plastic Ziploc bag. Painstakingly, he deposits the contents of the bag in the palm of her hand. Then he closes her fingers again to form a fist.
Good.
This was a last-minute idea. A nice little twist to keep them all guessing. to let the almighty Lucinda Sloane know that she no longer has control of her own life, that he controls her now. He controls everything. Picking up the pinky ring, he dredges it through the puddle of blood. He seals it into the Ziploc, dripping red, and puts the bag back into his pocket. And now, the grand finale. He takes out a tube of lipstick, uncaps it, gives it a twist, and pauses to admire the slanted, waxy tip. Then he runs it over the dead woman's lips, staining them a scarlet shade to match the pool of blood in which she lies. There. You're perfect, darling. Her gaping eyes seem to be fixed on his face now in vacant, terrified recognition, belying the fact that she never saw him coming. Not until the last moment. They never do. He takes one long, last look, then, satisfied, he leaves her. Just before closing the door behind him, he snakes a black glove around the door jamb to turn off the light, leaving her alone in the dark. She won't mind. Not now. Maybe she wouldn't have before, either. For all he knows, she was never afraid of the dark. But some people are. Some people are terrified. Outside, he takes her house key, a duplicate of the one he'd brazenly borrowed from her purse in an unguarded moment, and slides it under the welcome mat, just to make things a little easier when the time comes. You really have thought of everything, he congratulates himself. He pauses momentarily at the foot of the driveway to leave behind another calling card, placing it in a spot where it probably won't be discovered right away, if ever. But it's there. He always plays by the rules, at least when it comes to his own little game. He chuckles softly as he slips away into the night beneath the light of a full moon. Gazing out the passenger's side window at the federal brick row houses lining the cobblestone street, Lucinda reminds herself that she loves her new neighborhood. Really, she does. Philadelphia's Society Hill is safe, convenient, historic, beautiful, and very few people know to look for her here. That's the important thing. In the midst of the media attention following the Hastings case, her phone number and address were leaked on the internet. She was inundated with phone calls and drop-in visitors seeking her help. Families of missing persons from all over the country, private detectives, even a few furtive law enforcement agencies that made it clear she was their last resort. She moved last month, got an unlisted number and a new email address. It isn't that she no longer wants to work as a psychic detective, or that people haven't offered exorbitant fees for her services. On the contrary, she doesn't charge at all. She doesn't have to, thanks to family money. She lives very comfortably off the interest of her trust fund. But there are only so many people she can help, and she intends to stick with the old routine. Inspector Neil Bullard of the Philadelphia Police Department tells the families of missing persons about her and brings her on board if they're interested. They usually are, regardless of whether they believe in this stuff. People whose loved ones have vanished are desperate enough to try anything in order to bring them home. Here we are, Jimmy Molinaro, at the wheel beside her, announces as they pull up at the curb beneath the exceptionally dim yellow glow of a lamppost. Some people probably find the district's old-fashioned streetlights charming. Lucinda will take the bright white wattage of modern fixtures any day. Home sweet home. Jimmy puts the Mercedes into park and gestures up at the three-story brick townhouse. Lucinda murmurs in agreement, reluctant to admit that she feels about as at home here as she did on the Dutch Antilles island of Curacao, where the two of them just spent the long President's Day weekend. Their rented Caribbean villa was picturesque and upscale, but it wasn't comfortable. She wasn't comfortable. She couldn't quite relax, despite day after leisurely day spent in abundant warm sunshine with attentive staff doling out cocktails mixed with the island's namesake liqueur, the same inviting shade as the sparkling Caribbean Sea. Truly, there was no reason for her not to feel as though she had landed in paradise. It wasn't the place, though. It was the company. She gazes out the window at her building, bathed in the soft white glow of a waning moon and a luminescent dusting of snow. She's been anxious to get back here practically from the moment she left. Now that she's arrived, she finds herself inexplicably on edge. But like it or not, this is her home now. And it was almost like coming full circle, settling into the second-floor apartment of a 19th-century townhouse in one of the oldest, and probably wealthiest, too, neighborhoods in the Northeast. Not that Lucinda herself has ever lived in this particular area before, but she's willing to bet that her Sloane ancestors once inhabited these elegant, centuries-old homes, going right back to Philadelphia's colonial days.
"Your mother will be thrilled when she finds out where you've landed," her friend Bradley commented when he helped her move in.
"That's why I'm not going to mention it." Bradley knew the deal with her family, having also grown up in and been expelled from mainline society, albeit decades earlier. He peered at her over the cardboard dish carton he was holding.
"Pretty childish of you, don't you think, darling?"
"Absolutely, but I can't help it." Bitsy Sloane has a way of bringing out her daughter's unreasonable, petty side.
"I don't suppose you've got any of that pretty blue liqueur hanging around your kitchen for a nightcap?"
Jimmy asks her, obviously interested in prolonging their long weekend. "Fresh out," Lucinda says quickly, maybe too quickly, judging by the hurt dismay in his eyes.
"I was just kidding. I didn't actually think you had..."
"Oh, I know. Listen, I do have coffee," she offers, "if you want to come in for a cup." After all, Jimmy went all out this weekend. Plane tickets to the island, meals at the nicest restaurants, a chartered diving trip to Bonaire. Poor guy. He means well. He just isn't... An image of another man flashes into Lucinda's brain. She sighs inwardly. Okay, so Jimmy isn't Randy. But Randy isn't here. He's a 2-hour drive away from Philadelphia, on Long Beach Island, and God knows he isn't available. Jimmy, a good-looking, twice-divorced corporate lawyer with 2 teenaged daughters, is. He deserves a chance, remember? That's why you made yourself go out with him in the first place. She and Jimmy met entirely by chance, literally bumping into each other on the courthouse steps a few days after New Year's. They both had their heads bent against a bracing wind, both happened to be running late, both apologized profusely, and moved on.
"We've got to stop meeting like this,"
she heard a voice say a few days later in a Starbucks a few blocks from there, as she was waiting for her triple shot mocha with triple whipped cream. She looked up, and, surprise, there he was again. What a coincidence. They chatted over coffee, and she was pleased when he asked her out, particularly since he had no idea who she was, heiress to the Sloane fortune, or otherwise. In the wake of last summer's media splash, she's had her share of attention from guys who wanted to date a sexy soothsayer superhero. All of them had turned out to be opportunists in one way or another, not unlike the gold diggers who pursued her in her privileged youth. Jimmy was pleasantly clueless. He didn't recognize her from the papers or television, and when she told him her last name, he didn't ask, "Are you one of the Sloanes?" It wasn't until she left Starbucks that she started having second thoughts about accepting Jimmy's invitation to go to dinner. As the date drew nearer, she found countless excuses why she shouldn't date him. She actually called to cancel at the last minute, but lost her nerve when his voicemail picked up. The first date was fine. It led to an impulsive second, and more retrospective reluctance on Lucinda's part. But she convinced herself she was just out of practice. Dating one of the most eligible bachelors in Philadelphia wasn't such a horrible idea, given the state of her love life. And now, 6 weeks later, here they are. Not necessarily a couple, but a little too close for Lucinda's comfort.
"Coffee sounds good. Do you have decaf?"
Jimmy asks hopefully.
"Because I don't drink caffeine after 4 o'clock. It keeps me up all night, makes me crazy."
"We wouldn't want that." "No, decaf. Sorry."
"It's the truth," she notes, defending herself. To herself. Not that she can't offer him some other decaf beverage, but to his credit, Jimmy gives up more easily than she expected.
"Then I guess I'd better get going. I should call my kids and tell them I'm back in town, and I've got to unpack and repack for a business trip."
Maybe he, too, is aware that there's just no chemistry. He insists on escorting Lucinda and her luggage inside, leaving the silver Mercedes idling at the curb. Not necessarily a great idea in any urban neighborhood, but if she points that out, he might take it as an invitation to turn off the ignition and stick around after all. Anyway, she's noticed that he treats all the trappings of his wealth with the same casual disregard. He's got money to burn. That's what Neil Bullard said about Jimmy when Lucinda introduced the two men just last week. She hadn't necessarily expected the crusty old detective to hit it off with a guy whose idea of dressing down is exchanging black wingtips for black Gucci loafers. In fact, maybe that's why she had impulsively suggested that her longtime colleague, and okay, father figure, join her and Jimmy for lunch at Morton's that day. Maybe she wanted a good reason to stop seeing a perfectly nice guy. Neil, who has lived all his life over in 2 Street, and for a good part of it raised a large, tight-knit family on a police detective's shoestring budget, wasn't thrilled to see Jimmy leave most of his porterhouse entree on the plate.
"Irma could turn that hunk of beef into cheesesteak sandwiches to feed all my kids and grandkids for a couple of days,"
he later grumbled to Lucinda, who was well acquainted with and impressed by Mrs. Bullard's domestic thrift. Naturally, she welcomed the criticism with a quick, "You're right, I should stop seeing him."
"I didn't say that."
Neil raised a bushy white eyebrow at her. He knows her too well. Knows Randy, too. The three of them worked dozens of missing persons cases together back in the old days, before Randy moved away to Long Beach Island. She told Neil all about what happened out there last summer, of course. All except the part about sparking old feelings for Randy. But she didn't have to elaborate. Neil is a wise old guy. And Jimmy is a nice, not quite as old, though nearly a generation older than Lucinda, guy. And in the end, she couldn't come up with a good enough reason not to go away with him. He's well-traveled, well-mannered, well-spoken. A natural athlete, he skis, plays tennis and golf, and owns a sailboat he keeps moored, coincidentally, on Long Beach Island.
"You'll have to come sailing with me when the weather gets nice," he said.
And she imagined herself there with him, running into Randy. Then she wondered whether she's going to spend the rest of her life doing this, comparing every man she meets to the one who got away. Lucinda flips a light switch and picks up her mail in the lobby. Then she and Jimmy climb the steep, narrow staircase. At the top, she pulls her keys from her pocket, juggles the mail under her arm, and reaches for her bag.
"I can take that from here, thanks."
"Oh, I've got it."
"But your car is running."
"That's good for the engine after sitting idle in the cold parking lot for days. And what kind of jerk would I be if I made you carry your own bag?"
"It's not that heavy,"
she reminds him, echoing his own words when he lifted it from her bed before they left for the airport on Friday night.
"I've never seen a woman pack so little for an entire weekend," he comments now, with admiration, still carrying the bag.
She shouldn't be irritated that he didn't hand it over. He's just being polite. But Lucinda likes to do things for herself. She gets the impression that Jimmy's 2 ex-wives and teenaged daughters do not, and that they travel with suitcases full of resort wear in tow, unlike Lucinda, who who figured a weekend in the Caribbean required nothing more than a couple of pairs of shorts, flip-flops, and a bathing suit. Which was true. Although, when she found herself wearing the same t-shirt to the pool a few days in a row, she figured she might have underdone it. Just a little. Jimmy didn't seem to mind that Lucinda hadn't been entirely outfitted by Tommy Bahama before the trip. In fact, he kept complimenting her on whatever she was wearing. He also complimented her on being so low maintenance, and one night, when she'd had too much rum, he actually complimented her on her dancing, which, in retrospect, casts serious doubt on his overall sincerity. Too many compliments. There are worse problems, she reminds herself. As a rule, she doesn't do guilt. Yet somehow Jimmy manages to bring it out in her. What does your week look like?
Crazy, as usual.
Not really. She sticks the key into the deadbolt.
How about yours?
Crazy as usual. I've got to fly away again tomorrow.
Right, his business trip.
He's mentioned it a few times over the weekend. She should probably ask him where he's going, but that would prolong the conversation, and she's tired.
And I don't really care.
Why, oh why, can't she make herself care? Life would be so much easier if she fell in love with Jimmy. He's the kind of guy she could even bring home to her mother. And that, in a nutshell, is probably why you'll never let yourself fall in love with Jimmy. Nice, Lucinda.
Very healthy.
Very mature. Let's get together for dinner next weekend, he says. It's more a suggestion than an outright invitation, so she can't exactly say no. You can't answer a question nobody's asked. Whatever. She should probably see him at least once more. Let him down easy. And hey, you never know. Maybe he'll start to grow on you. He leans in and kisses her on the lips. Nah.
Thanks for everything, Jimmy.
She reaches around the door jamb and turns on an interior light.
I had a really nice time.
So did I. I'll call you. Something snaps inside of Lucinda. Before she can stop herself, she hears herself saying, I don't think we should see each other anymore. Jimmy's dark eyebrows shoot toward his equally dark hairline, both expertly salon-dyed, she suspects.
I'm so sorry, she says helplessly. It just doesn't feel right.
She debates adding a cliché line to soften the blow, like, it's not you, it's me. Or maybe something about wanting to stay friends. But that's not true. She doesn't want to stay friends. It would be awkward. And it is him. He's not her type. She can't change that. I'm surprised you feel that way, Lucinda. I thought things were going well. And you just said you had a nice time.
I lied. I'm an idiot.
I'm sorry, she says again. You're a great guy, and I'm really glad we met. I just can't do this. It's okay. With a sad smile, he waves a black leather-gloved hand at her and heads down the stairs. Lucinda steps into her chilly apartment, kicks the door closed, leans against it, and heaves a tremendous sigh of relief. Jimmy will be fine, she's sure. Maybe it was cruel to cut him loose on the heels of a lavish weekend trip, but spending so much time together made it obvious to her that it wasn't going to work. Wouldn't it have been more cruel to lead him on even a little while longer? Maybe not. Who knows? I stink at relationships, she announces to the empty room. But it had to be done. Oh, geez. Now I'm talking to myself, she adds. Pathetic. She pushes her weight off the wall with her foot and turns on a lamp before turning off the overhead light. There. The place seems a little cozier and more welcoming, although she still isn't entirely comfortable. Turning up the heat will help, but that's not all that's missing. On the plane this afternoon, she felt anxious to get back to Philadelphia. Now she wonders why. This quiet place feels isolated compared to her old neighborhood. That's not all. Something else is bothering her tonight here. She can't put her finger on what it is. She's certainly used to coming home to an empty apartment. She's been doing it all her adult life. In fact, she's always reveled in it after years of living under the tight reins of her parents, her nannies, and teachers at the Millwood Academy. Tonight, though, she feels uneasy about being alone. Guess what? You're probably lonely. Admit it. You need someone to talk to. Someone other than Jimmy. Someone like Bradley, who hasn't been back to Philly in over a month. He's not one of her oldest friends. Well, other than age-wise. But he is one of her fondest, ever since they met at his cousin's society wedding and hit it off instantly as fellow pariahs. He was sitting alone, and so was she. The next thing she knew, they were laughing, then cutting up the dance floor. "How is it that we've never met before?" he asked as he whirled her around. "Oh, I don't go to these things very often if I can help it, even if I happen to be invited. I'm the family black sheep."
"So am I," he exclaimed delightedly. "Disowned eons ago. You?"
"Not disowned, exactly.
More like shunned?"
"Exactly." She didn't bother to tell him that she was both shunny and shunner.
"What was your crime?"
"My parents couldn't accept who I am or my lifestyle."
"Same here. You're gay too? And in the theater?"
"No. Psychic."
"I love it," he screamed.
Bradley's extended family, those in his own generation anyway, have apparently felt no monetary obligation, though they do keep in touch. Not that anyone made an effort to speak to him at the wedding, Lucinda noticed. "Yes, she misses Bradley," she acknowledges as she removes the rubber band from the bundle of mail in her hand and flips through it. "She misses Cam Hastings, too. She's away this week on a ski trip with her husband's family, one that, as she privately admitted to Lucinda the last time they spoke, she wasn't particularly looking forward to. Lucinda and Cam forged a fast friendship, the way people do when they're thrown together under unique circumstances, like boarding school, or summer camp, or using psychic impressions to catch a serial killer. All in a day's work for Lucinda. For Cam, not so much. She'd never talked to anyone about her so-called gift, nor had Lucinda, really. Not on an intimate note-comparing basis. It was a relief to both of them to realize that someone understood. Lucinda drove up to Montclair every couple of weeks throughout the fall to visit her and Mike and Tess. Then, just before Thanksgiving, Cam gave birth to a baby girl. She got busy, the weather got bad, Lucinda moved to her new place. She hasn't seen the Hastings family since Christmas time, nor spoken to Cam in over a week. "Thank God for Neil," Lucinda thinks as she throws her coat on a hook. "He's right here in Philly, and he's not going anywhere, even though his wife, Irma, retired last June and has been begging him to do the same."
"What would I do with myself if I retired?" he frequently asks Lucinda.
"You'd relax, spend time with your family. Neil has 6 grandchildren, including a newborn, with yet another on the way."
"I already spend time with them, constantly, and I don't like to relax. Relaxing makes me nervous."
Typical Neil. And typical me. Lucinda isn't big on relaxation either. She moved into this apartment mere weeks ago, but has long since been unpacked, put away, organized, even decorated. If you can call hanging a few framed black and white prints on the wall, decorating. There's still a lot to do, but she'll get it done. She's always been full of nervous energy, fueled, no doubt, by liberal daily doses of caffeine and chocolate. Not the healthiest of habits, but hardly the worst. She makes a mental note to take her iPod out of her coat pocket later. She should return it to the docking station Bradley bought her for Christmas after she mentioned that she was always losing track of it. What a waste to bring it to Curacao. She had downloaded a couple of new playlists in advance of the trip, hoping to relax and tune in on the plane, on the beach, on the oceanfront balcony. But Jimmy likes to talk. A lot. Yes, cutting him loose was definitely the right thing to do. She kicks off her sneakers and leaves them beside several other scattered pairs on the mat next to the door. Then, carrying her luggage and the mail, flipping on a couple of lights to dispel the shadows, she detours to the kitchen. There, she sorts through the mail and finds a cardboard sleeve from an online media store addressed to her. She orders books and DVDs from there pretty frequently, but not in the last week or so. Was something back-ordered, and she forgot about it? She opens the envelope and pulls out a DVD. She reads the title aloud, perplexed. Moonstruck? She saw it years ago, and it's on television all the time. She definitely didn't order it. Must be a mistake. Looking at the invoice, she sees that it was ordered online through her account and billed to the credit card she keeps on file there. Must be a mistake. She puts it aside to deal with later. The only other thing of interest is a letter from Norwegian Cruise Lines. Lucinda's eyes widen as she reads it. Well, how about that? Last summer, when she called customer service after she missed her scheduled Alaskan cruise, she'd been told that because she hadn't purchased trip insurance, she was out the several thousand dollars she'd paid for 7 days in a luxury suite. Looks like customer service was wrong. According to this letter, she's been rebooked on a cruise for this summer, in the same luxury suite. All she has to do is call the customer service telephone number listed on the letterhead, give the reference number, and confirm the dates. I'll do it right now, before I forget. She picks up the phone and dials the number. Norwegian Cruise Lines, a cheerful male customer service rep says. How may I help you? I just got a letter about rebooking an Alaskan cruise for this June because I had to cancel last year at the last minute. I was originally told that I wouldn't be able to rebook, so I was a little surprised by this. When last year was your cruise scheduled?
In August, on the Norwegian Star.
We only sail to Alaska during the summer months, and we're usually sold out through September. Whoever you spoke to should have explained that it was too late to rebook for last summer, but we can certainly get you on one of this summer's first Alaskan sailings.
Oh, well, she didn't explain that. I thought it was a lost cause.
I apologize. Do you have the name of the person you spoke to? I'd be happy to look into it for you.
No, it's all right.
Lucinda probably should have asked more questions.
Let's just confirm the new date.
I'll be glad to do that for you. Do you have a reference number?
She gives it to him, hears him clicking away on a computer keyboard. All these months, she'd thought the trip was a loss.
Typical misinformed customer service reps. All right, Ms. Sloan, we have you in suite 11520 on the Star. Same as before. The new sale date is June 14th, and your confirmation number is IP06141120. She grabs a pen and pad and jots it down.
Thank you. Do you need anything else from me?
No, you're all set. We'll send your confirmation and your new ticket a few weeks before sailing. All you need to do is show up. You have a good night now.
You too.
Wow, that was easy. Thinking about Alaska in February isn't particularly appealing, but she'll definitely be looking forward to it by June. Too bad it's such a long ways away. She grabs a Three Musketeers bar from the freezer before heading into the bedroom. Even without shoes, her footsteps seem to echo through the drafty rooms. The place has hardwood floors, high ceilings, and lots of tall windows that probably need draperies, if Lucinda can bring herself to obscure some of the scarce winter daylight. There's no daylight now. There is moonlight, which she'd be able to see if she turned off the interior lights. But she won't, of course. So there's only glare on the glass. She'll have to do something about the windows soon. And about the leaky faucet she can hear in the bathroom. Odd, because she could swear she turned it off tightly to stop the dripping before she left Friday night. She even used a wrench. Now, When she stops to examine the faucet, she finds that the handle turns easily. How did that happen? When she takes the wrench from the gilt-mirrored medicine cabinet and forces the handle as far back to the right as she can, the way she did on Friday night, the dripping ceases. Frowning, she waits a few minutes to make sure. No drips. Wrapping her fingers around the handle, she tugs it hard enough to turn the faucet on, then turns it off just enough to stop the flow, the way one might if he or she were unaware of the leak. After a moment, a droplet of water plunks into the sink. Moments later, another. Okay, you don't honestly believe someone came into the apartment while you were gone and used the sink, do you? Maybe it loosened on its own then. Whatever. Shaking her head at her own dubious expression in the ugly gold-framed mirror, she tightens it once more, stashes the wrench in the cabinet again, and leaves the bathroom. Back in the hall, she turns up the heat on the thermostat and hears a prompt hissing through the registers. There, that's better. With the chill gone and lights on, she'll feel more at home. It's really a nice apartment, nicer than her last place. Just not Lucinda's style. The crown moldings and antique fixtures, major selling points in the real estate ad, along with newly replaced wiring and, ha, upgraded plumbing, are a little too fussy for her taste. And the place has a musty, yesteryear smell she's still getting used to. It reminds her of rainy days and old books and her grandmother's cedar closet. Not unpleasant, just not my style. It's getting to be a refrain. The apartment, Jimmy. What is my style? No, she immediately cautions her wayward brain. Don't you dare go there again. Married men are not your style. In the bedroom, she turns on two more